And good Friday morning, everybody. Welcome to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. It's the 1st of August, 2014. A wonderful Friday morning indeed after a few days of rain. As you may have heard Hannah Lee mention a moment or two ago, we're expecting maybe temperatures around 80 degrees today along the Front Range. It doesn't get any better than that. And in the spirit of summer and nice temperatures, we are going to be talking about going barefoot this morning. This morning's Connections will be in two parts. The first half of the program will be spent with Stephanie Welch from the Society for Barefoot Living. For the second half, we'll try to cover the first 4.5 billion years of Earth's history with Professor Robert M. Hazen from George Mason University. But back to the barefoot theme, joining me now by telephone from Massachusetts is Stephanie Welch, upcoming author of The Human Body User Manual, Volume 1. Stephanie is a licensed massage therapist who holds a bachelor's degree in classics and a master's in art history from Boston University. Stephanie is an activist with the Society for Barefoot Living, in addition to being a modern paleo saving the world through evolutionary biology. Stephanie, good morning. Welcome to KGNU.
Hi, Roger. Can you hear me?
Yep, can hear you. You sound good. Glad to have you.
Excellent. Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. Well, the first question that comes to mind before we delve too deeply into going barefoot, what is modern paleo? What does that mean?
Oh, well, that's a sort of a nutritional approach. So a lot of people may have heard of the paleo diet, and it's something that a lot of people who do CrossFit follow. But basically, it's the idea that our bodies evolved with certain expectations for their food and nutrient consumption, and following along what we evolved with makes the most sense for our body. So it's a way of looking at nutrition with that in mind. The modern aspect is saying, of course, we're not exactly trying to do exactly what our Paleolithic ancestors did, but we're kind of trying to use that to inform our modern choices.
Okay, very good. Also, for a little bit of Barefooting 101, what is the Society for Barefoot Living? Tell us a bit about them.
So we have, for barefooters, there's not a lot of local community presence. That's one of the things I've been actually trying to remedy in the recent past. But so there's a lot of online communities that we work with, and so we have a Facebook group that has about 3,600 members. We have a Yahoo mailing list that has pretty active participation, and through barefooters.org, people can apply and to become official members of the organization. So these are ways that we connect online, find each other, share resources, and help one another.
Okay, well, like I suggested just a moment or two ago, we're smack dab in the middle of summer, as it were, August 1st. But to be honest with you, even though we've had a lot of rainy weather here along the Front Range, for most of the summer so far, I haven't seen very many people wandering around barefoot. Occasionally, kids in the front yard without shoes, maybe people at, we do have beaches here, believe it or not, at some of the lakes. Occasionally, people barefoot there. But in general, people seem to be very attached to their shoes. Give us a little bit of history about shoes and people wearing shoes.
Yeah, well, you know, shoes have only been in sort of common usage for about the last 30,000 years or so. I mean, no other animal on the planet wears shoes, and we got along without them for a very, very long time of our history. So by about 30,000 years ago, we were already as far away from Africa as places like Europe and China and Australia before we had taken up consistent usage of shoes. So we managed to get along quite well without them for a very long time. In the more recent past, a lot of things happened. They've been, you know, a marker of social status. In the, 1600s, 1700s, they were very fashionable to, you know, have high-heeled shoes, especially for many of Louis XIV and famous portraits with high-heeled shoes. And so they actually men took up high heels before women did, but they became a fashion and status symbol. And now we have attempted to do to improve our ability to do things like run by wearing, you know, these athletic shoes that are designed to cushion the heel and create extra padding and all these supposed advancements over what our feet are naturally able to do. And as a result, we've actually ended up misusing our innate you know, anatomy and biomechanics, and weakening many of those things. You know, so many people have foot problems and flat feet and other issues these days, and it really comes from not using the feet to their full capability and not allowing the information from your feet to inform and tell the rest of your body unconsciously how to move better.
And I want to address biomechanics and athletic shoes and all the different health aspects of going barefoot. I mean, that was really compelling in preparing for this program. But I caught you on one point relative to what I learned reading your materials online in preparation, and that is there is one other species that wears shoes. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, that's only because we put them there, but it's horses, actually. So horses are the only other animal that's consistently wearing shoes these days. And, you know, it started out to protect their hooves from shoes with horses, we put them there to protect them from the effects of being in stalls, so that the hooves would get damaged by the wet and the dirty conditions. And so that was something that we devised to resolve that, but since we have learned that actually that's causing a lot of problems for them. For example, the Houston Police Department has a mounted patrol that they have recently turned into a completely barefoot horse patrol, because they've actually found that it has resolved a lot of physical problems that they were having with the horses, lameness and even behavioral problems. And so the horses were really suffering in the shoes. And so now that they've taken them off, they have to do a bit of rehabilitation for the horses as well, as we often have to do when we come out of shoes after being in them for so long. But they've actually found many improvements in the health and the behavior of the horses since they've taken the shoes off of the horses.
Okay. I think we've covered enough on the horses, and apparently they suffer from shoes as well as we do, which brings me to, I guess, your central theme or point. Tell us a bit more of why shoes cause us problems. You certainly mentioned athletic shoes, and, you know, my suspicions rose in that regard, in that, well, if you're wearing athletic shoes, you're doing athletic things like running a marathon, and it seems we invented the running shoe to protect us for the marathon. But from the materials I've read online on your site, it's actually the opposite. So tell us a little bit about the problems athletic shoes and regular shoes are causing us in general.
Well, one of the things most people first focus on is the physical impediment with moving and using the foot naturally. So one of the things, obviously, is, for example, heel elevation. And most people, when a lot of women, you know, put on high heel shoes and they think as long as they can suffer through the pain in their feet, everything's just fine. But they don't consider what the effect is on the entire body of having an elevation like that. In order to stay upright, if you were to take, say, if you take your bookshelf and you put a couple of books underneath the back edge of your bookshelf and tip it up, the whole thing tilts forward quite significantly. And when you put a person in high heels, you don't see them tilting forward. And the reason is because they're making all sorts of subtle compensations as the body naturally wants to remain upright and level. Your eyes help it determine, and your sense of equilibrium help it determine how it needs to be positioned. So it makes all these subtle corrections. So we don't notice the effects that these are having from, this is, you know, high-heeled shoes or the athletic shoes, what they call the drop in the shoes, the difference in millimeters from the back to the front, which is supposed to be there to cushion us, but actually, you know, affects the alignment quite a bit. And there's also, of course, the idea of the shoes are compressing our feet and keeping the toes from being able to do their jobs independently. And that's why some companies came up with the ideas like the Vibram five-finger shoes, or some people just call them the toe shoes that you might see people around in. And the idea there is, well, if we could, you know, wear a shoe, but it would permit our physical movements to be more similar to what we would be barefoot, then, you know, maybe that would resolve our problems. But the Vibram company just suffered a lawsuit, and they've just settled for almost $4 million because those, what they supposedly said as health claims, were considered not to be substantiated. And my take on that is it's because we've focused on these physical aspects, but we've neglected the neurological component. So shoes not only physically interfere with the position that our body's in and the ability of the foot to move and to do its jobs, but they also take away the sensory information from our feet, because so much of movement is neurological. Your brain is sending signals to your muscles as to how to fire, and this is mostly unconsciously happening. And it needs that information from the extremities in order to, for your brain to tell the rest of your body from the core outward how to move and how to coordinate with the rest of its parts. So if you take away that sensory information from the feet, even with just a couple of millimeters of rubber as the Vibram or other minimalist shoes have, that sort of false sense of protection that you get is actually one of the things that's dramatically inhibiting your ability to coordinate your entire body and keep good alignment and encourage your muscles to do all of their jobs. And so it's got the physical component, but it's also got a huge neurological component that is very underappreciated.
I had forgotten about that. I don't want to pick on one particular brand, but what comes to mind is the five finger. It's kind of a glove for your toe. And we see quite a bit of that around here in the mountains. A lot of hiking here, of course, west of Boulder in Denver. And occasionally you'll run across people on the trail wearing those. Would you advocate or suggest then that they not use those? What would it be you would prefer they were barefoot on the trail?
Well, so ideally, if you can get away with being barefoot, that is one of the best things to do. But what's important is that a lot of people sort of put on the shoe and they think that that's going to either solve the problem or do what it is that they need to do. I think that those shoes can be potentially a helpful tool from time to time, as long as you're aware and understanding that what really has to change and adapt is how you move. And so, for example, with running or other activities, you know, if you put the shoes on and you still don't have all of that proprioceptive and sensory information from your feet, it's very easy to hurt yourself through excessive impact forces or repetitive strain, stress fractures and things, if you don't also know that you need to learn how to move. But it's not a bad thing to have the protection from time to time. If it helps you do something like, you know, that hiking and trails can be difficult, especially if there are gravelly areas, hopefully you get a chance to experience how manageable it actually is, and that a lot of this information is really just that, is information. Is the feet are intentionally very, very sensitive because it's a feature, not a flaw. The you feel discomfort long before there's actually any injury. So it's there to tell you to move more gently, to shift your weight, you know, so that you don't actually suffer any abrasions or puncture wounds or damage, which is fairly rare, especially as you become more accustomed to it. The feet become very, very resilient and very durable, and the skin thickens a little bit, but it's actually largely also about your being accustomed to how they're feeling and being able to learn to move more gently. So I'm not completely opposed to the shoes. It's just the context of understanding them as a tool to use within learning how to better work with your own body.
I know in some of your writings you described it almost as you mentioned a tool just now, but in your writing suggesting it's a tool like a pair of gloves would be. We don't always wear gloves, but occasionally they're needed.
Yes, it's a really good way to think about it. We're accustomed to the idea that the default state of our hands is barehanded. And when certain circumstances come up, you know, I use an oven mitt in my kitchen. I wear gloves sometimes when it's cold out in the wintertime. If I was doing a task that I was particularly, you know, I knew that was going to be too tough for my hands, then I might put on a glove for, you know, any type of activity that would be appropriate for. But we haven't given our feet enough credit for actually being capable of transporting us and surviving on the actual ground. You know, I walk around in the city of Boston, and so there's concrete, asphalt, brick, pebbles, all kinds of things. And I've suffered the minimal injury to my feet. There, I, you know, people often ask to look at them, and they, I suppose they expect that there are going to be gashes and scabs and things like that, and they look just, you know, sort of like normal, normal feet with, you know, a little bit of thickening in a couple of places and, you know, maybe a little more dirt on them.
Okay, 8:45 is the time. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. My guest this morning is Stephanie Welch. She's the upcoming author of The Human Body User Manual, Volume 1, and she's also an activist with the Society for Barefoot Living, which we're talking about right now. And Stephanie, in preparation for the program, I drove the 30 miles into the studio this morning barefoot, and I'll have to admit it felt pretty darn good, but I was thinking the whole way, I'd better not speed, because what happens if the police pull me over and I'm bent over frantically trying to tie my shoes back into place? What's your take?
Well, there's this myth. There are many actual myths about going barefoot and health codes and things, but the idea that driving barefoot is illegal is also another myth. And there's only one case that I know of, and that's in Alabama. You can't drive a motorcycle barefoot. But everywhere else in any other vehicle that I know of in the U.S., there's no laws against driving barefoot. So this is it's just a myth, and I'm not sure where this one came from exactly.
Okay, we can thank Alabama for so many other things as well. moving along, though, what about the idea of going into the local restaurant barefoot? Or here I'm in the studio, of course, KGNU will let me do anything I want. But going to the local restaurants here in Boulder, or going back home to Denver, and going into Home Depot without my shoes on, what's going to happen to me?
So one of the efforts that the Society for Barefoot Living has undertaken is to do a letter-writing campaign and acquire letters from all 50 state health departments assuring us that there are no state health codes anywhere that require customers of a business to wear shoes. It is up to local municipalities to potentially have ordinances or health codes from their city health departments. So if it's prudent to check with those. We're not, there are very few that we're aware of. There's a few outlying cities in Massachusetts, I think Maynard and maybe a couple of others, that have city regulations to some degree. But for the most part, they mostly don't exist. Often, you know, there's signs on businesses that will say, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service, or similar admonitions like that. But it's up to the individual business's discretion if they choose to have a dress code for their customers. So they do have the right to do that. But many employees, if they'll come up to you and say, I'm sorry, you have to have shoes to be in here, they actually are actually just mistaken. And they just think that because of this pervasive myth of health codes and things like that, they think that it's necessary to ask you to leave without shoes. But not only are there no health codes for the most part, no state health codes, and very few local health codes, it's also not nearly so much of a liability issue as many are afraid of. What a business has to do to provide appropriate care for its customers, of barefoot or not, is, you know, to try and avoid any potential hazards to their customers, and if any hazards exist, is to warn them. So, for example, you see wet floor signs, you know, and those apply, obviously, to people with shoes on or no shoes. That's there to warn you that there's a hazard that the business is aware of, that it wants to make sure that you're not going to suffer any damage from. And by warning you, they fulfill their obligation in that regard. And as far as the barefoot themselves, by going barefoot, we take it upon ourselves, if we injure ourselves specifically on account of being barefoot, it constitutes contributory negligence. So that actually, you know, the business is not at fault for that either. So it's taking it kind of upon ourselves. So those are the two top reasons that most businesses will try to, you know, maybe ask you to leave or tell you that you need to put on your shoes. Sometimes if you just are able to have a positive conversation and inform the person, you will be given clearance to stay, and I've actually successfully done that a number of times. Sometimes they will be adamant citing it as a dress code, and, you know, they sort of want to keep up appearances and not have other customers who are also potentially uninformed or just don't like the sight of feet, but it is, it's basically, it's a down to a dress code issue and whether or not you can get clearance from the individual business.
I don't like the sight of some of the other customers, but what I was thinking of is after the show, I'll probably wander into King Soopers, our local grocery here, and buy my regular tube of Pringles. You're suggesting that I don't become a militant over this, just casually bring it to the clerk's attention that there's no law against it, but if they insist, cooperate. Is that what you're telling us?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, a business does have a right to have a dress code if they choose, and going barefoot is, as of yet, not a protected class in the way that, you know, businesses can't discriminate based on race or ethnicity or religion or things like that. We are not yet considered a protected class, so we don't technically have rights in that regard. You can, there's also the Americans with Disabilities Act. Some use to cite that for either, I believe, religious or physical limitations that require them to not wear shoes. Some people have doctor's notes if they really have had a serious physical problem and the doctor has noted their recovery association with going barefoot. Some have doctor's notes. But, you know, what we also want to do is try and promote a positive image that we're not actually, you know, out trying to cause trouble. We're not just trying to prove a point. This is, you know, this is what we choose to do for our health and personal reasons, and it's not against any health codes. It's not putting them at liability risk, and really we just want to cooperate and have everyone, you know, work together in a friendly way and be able to continue to go about our business and patronize their establishments if they're willing to accept us.
You mentioned a class of people, as it were, barefooters. Do you have a sense of how many people regularly go barefoot as just a normal part of their daily existence? Do we have any sense of how big this movement might be?
Well, that's one of the things I've been struggling with. In public in Boston, I see hardly any other barefooters ever. I ran across one last about a week ago as I was just on my way from home. And that was the first time I had encountered someone that I didn't either personally convert or first meet online and meet up with outside. So I'm having trouble finding people locally. So what I've actually started to try to do is I've just established the Boston Urban Barefoot League. So I've set up a Facebook and meetup group for those. And so we're just trying to gather, starting with the online, because there are many, many people online, but they're very active forums on Facebook, and as I mentioned, the Yahoo group. If you go to barefooters.org, you can, you know, register with them and get onto, like, the Yahoo groups and things like that. But finding in person, it's just because there are so many fears and myths and all this, there are just not that many of us visible at this point, and so we're working on that.
I do know that at barefooters.org, Society for Barefoot Living, I think there are about 1,500 subscribers just to their email list alone. That seems substantial. I know it's not much in a country of 1/3 billion people, but apparently it's growing. There seems to be interest in it.
It's definitely growing. It's definitely out there. There's different. But like the running community is one where it started coming up for a while. That's been fading out a little bit, partly with the Vibrams. It's not been panning out the way that they thought, but largely that's because most of the people who have been in that movement haven't been going completely barefoot or haven't appreciated the difference between minimalist and completely barefoot. But like I said, the Facebook group for the Society for Barefoot Living, They're expanding really rapidly. They just hit around 3,600 members, and you know, there's lots of communication online. We're just working to find each other locally so that we can start to be more visible.
Certainly. Unfortunately, we don't have a whole lot of time left together, but I wanted to address the elderly. I mentioned earlier I've seen people on the trail with the five fingers and people at the beach barefoot, but I don't recall ever seeing elderly people wandering around grocery stores or on the sidewalk barefoot. Can you address that, or do you know much about it?
Well, it's a little bit unfortunate in some ways. as we age, we lose some of the proprioceptive and neurological capabilities in the feet, particularly if we're in shoes all the time. The fat pads on the feet kind of reduce, and the just by lack of using them, we sort of atrophy both, you know, the musculature and the sensory connections. Some studies have shown that going barefoot can actually help prevent falls in elderly by improving their balance. So, you know, if you're getting away from that elevation that's easier to tip over or slip, and trying to get back as much feeling as possible in the feet. I have a client in my practice, and she's doing some vertigo rehabilitation and vestibular retraining, and she says she always makes sure that she gets toes barefoot in her physical therapy rehabilitation sessions to get the maximum amount of information to keep balance and, you know, to keep that strength and keep the loading in the bones is part of what helps keep them actually from developing osteoporosis, is to keep the proper loading on the bones. It's really, it's the use it or lose it thing. As people get older, if they're not using it, they are going to lose it. And it's, trying to maintain as much barefoot and much activity and, you know, with the right mechanics, without these heel elevations and all these things, is part of what can help keep your balance, keep your strength, and prevent injuries and difficulties as you get older.
Stephanie, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. Let's take this opportunity to let folks know more about what you do, where they can learn about your work, maybe read your book once it's released. Tell us, give us some contact information.
Yeah, so the website that I've been using to promote the book that I'm working on is humanbodyusermanual.com. So I'm working on putting a lot of stuff up there, some blog posting, trying to, share just some shorter thoughts. And working on the book as I'm slowly writing and trying to release a little bit of it. I have a newsletter on there that you can sign up for as well, and I'm going to be setting it up so that when you sign up for the newsletter, you get to preview a chapter of the book as I'm working on it. So that's available. My massage practice is in Cambridge, which is right the next door to Boston in Massachusetts. So you can also see people here for orthopedic massage and consultations, things like that. But mainly check out my website. That was humanbodyusermanual.com, and that's kind of where I'll be sharing everything from there.
Okay, Stephanie, well, thanks so much for appearing on KGNU this morning. You've been a delight.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Okay, great. Happy bare feet to you, or whatever the greeting is. Thank you again. Okay, my guest has been Stephanie Welch. She's an activist with the Society for Barefoot Living, and she's also the upcoming author of the Human Body User Manual, Volume 1, and she gave her website information out just a moment ago. Up next is going to be Dr. Robert M. Hazen. He's a research scientist, and we're going to be talking about the first 4.5 billion years of Earth's history, and we're going to squeeze that into our remaining 35 minutes here at KGNU. Again, you're listening to Connections. I'm Roger Wendell. The time is 8:58, and this is KGNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM, with translator K229AC in Nederland, Colorado, at 93.7 megahertz. And again, we'll be back in a moment with Dr. Hazen, but first this.
Gotcha. It's a necessary thing. Counter culture. It'll set your mind free. Counter culture. Tell you what's the name.